It has been a very romantic idea in some times that peasants preserve nature. I am not so sure of that. My impression is that the destruction of nature, for instance, in my own country, in Germany, was to a large extent the work of agriculture, and that the help against this was invented by agricultural chemistry in the 19th century. Now, of course, since this was invented, one has again made the same kind of mistake which is always made. Since we know a means against impoverishment of the soil, we use so much of artificial things that this again destroys much of the nature. So one must be cautious. One must always know the measure, know how far to go. But in any case, I think there is something to it that this problem of the enmity between man and nature is at least as old as agriculture, and certainly as city civilizations and empires. Number two, about the empires, about the great civilizations. We admire that they have lasted for 3,000 or 4,000 years. Now, in geological measures, or even compared with the Paleolithic cultures, this is very little. It's a very fast step by which civilization has gone forward, only 4,000 years. But in our view, this is quite long. Now, this stability of the Chinese, the Hindu, the ancient Egyptian, and even the European culture, which all have at least lasted for 3,000 years. If you look in detail, you find out that it was not so stable. Their way of self-expression by art and so on was stable, and perhaps their gods were stable. But if you read chroniclers, you find there have been 200 years, perhaps, of a good time. In the beginning, a very good emperor, a very good king, a good ruler, wise and friendly. Later on, still quite good rulers. Then bad rulers, ugly people, and finally weak rulers, and in China in general, at the end, a nasty woman. I don't know why the Chinese men are so very much against that, but in any case, even Mao Zedong was gifted with such one. And then the whole thing breaks down. And then you have 200 years, 300 years of great difficulties, and then it begins again, and you have again a new good ruler, and the whole cycle is repeated. Why that? I don't think that the moralism of this matter, of this description, is really the right description. My impression is that it is economic, ecological. If you want to be a good ruler, a beloved ruler, you must know that you live in a slowly growing economy, in which what you cannot give now, you can give 5 years from now. And that's very good, and then you can be kind, if at the same time you are a wise person. But then you always come in the end to the limits to growth, because every civilization with its technological means has certain limits to growth. And when the limits to growth are reached, I think Joseph in Egypt was just a man who realized that, and therefore he became so famous. Then when that is reached, there is only the choice either of governing without compromise. And such a man who is able to do that is called a bad ruler, a nasty man. Or one is unable to do it, and a man who is unable to do it is called a weak ruler. So in the end, you just run against the difficulties provided by the necessity of growth, which cannot go on indefinitely. That's my impression. Now, this means that the conflict between man and the natural surrounding, the natural environment, is quite old. But in our days, technology and population growth have made it far more difficult than it was before, and far more dangerous. And I should like to end by mentioning part of the difficulties I see there. Now, these again are problems for specialists. In general, it is important to know quite a lot about geology and about biology and about many things in order to give the right answers. But some of the answers are there. Clean water and clean air. That is a thing you can provide on a national basis if you have the right legislation. And it has been done. In Bavaria, where I live, or in Switzerland, where my wife comes from, the lakes today are much cleaner than they were before, than they were 20 years ago. This can be done. But even the River Rhine has not been cleaned because it is an international problem, and the nations bordering to the Rhine have not been able to solve the problem so far. And they are even good friends. It's not the problem that they are enemies, but they are unable to agree on what to do for the Rhine. And if you go to larger problems, larger international problems, it becomes more and more difficult. The ozone layer is a similar case, where a full international agreement would be needed for protecting it. Forests. I think the most difficult, great problem is perhaps the problem of providing energy. And I should like to say a few words about that in slightly more detail. Energy, as we generally see it, is a necessary means of doing anything technologically successful. And we have, if I see it rightly, only three different sources of energy which are sufficiently quantitatively strong to solve the problem of the energy demand as it is seen today and as it might increase tomorrow. This is fossil fuels, this is nuclear energy and solar energy. And I feel that all three have great drawbacks, and I don't see for which I should vote. When I was younger, as a nuclear scientist came out of the war, I shared the view of all of us nuclear scientists that of course nuclear energy was the solution, completely friendly to the environment and inexhaustible more or less. Now I'm no longer so sure. But let me begin by fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are, first of all, it's a nonsense to burn up these wonderful chemical substances which have been built during millions of years and to burn them within 200 or 300 years. So this is perhaps not dangerous, but it's nonsense. Next point, they produce a lot of secondary gases, secondary substances, which, for instance, in our country destroy the forests and do a lot of disagreeable things. I don't know to which extent this is present today in America, in Germany, it's quite clear. And the worst thing probably is the carbon dioxide, which is produced by any burning. So you cannot change that by different chemical procedures, which, as far as estimates go to today, might produce within, say, 50 years, or I don't know exactly how long, an increase in the average temperature of the atmosphere, which might lead to melting down of the polar ice caps. And this might mean, well, Ithaca would be safe, but New York City would not. Also, the climatic changes which would be induced by that might make it necessary for whole nations to move to other places. So that's certainly a very, at least very, very disagreeable thing. So I cannot be in favor of going on with fossil fuels. Nuclear energy, as I said in the beginning, seemed to us quite good. Then, especially the nuclear scientists, those who were concerned with nuclear safety, found a lot of difficulties, mainly with radioactive waste. And this has come into the public understanding, at least in my country, around 1975. And at present, we have a very strong feeling in the public against nuclear energy. Quite recently, I read in a newspaper that for the very first time in France, an opinion poll gave a majority against nuclear energy, which I was quite surprised to hear. But it may be so. Now, the question is this danger real? I must say that things like that accident of Chernobyl have not impressed me very much, because I think this was just unforgivably bad work, both in the construction and in the management. So one might hope that this will be done better. But in any case, it is not very nice to know that if bad work is done, such consequences may come from it. And the thing which makes me really doubt in the value of nuclear energy is that I have no certainty whatsoever that where reactors are, there will be no more anymore, no war anymore. I feel if we had solved the problem of war, I would be far more confident for nuclear energy. I remember Alvin Weinberg, who certainly knows about these things, having saying, I think 15 years ago or even longer, do you give me 1,000 years of peace? I shall give you 1,000 years of energy. And that's a good way of speaking about this causal connection. But nobody can give him 1,000 years of peace today. So the problem of peace is a problem which is very closely connected, even with our environmental policy. And as long as that is not solved, I feel that I cannot now speak in favor of nuclear energy anymore. Next point, solar energy. Well, solar energy is certainly inexhaustible in a way. And as far as you can use it locally, it is wonderful. I think for heating, it will be a very good thing. But it is very diffuse. And if you want to collect solar energy in such a manner that you can drive all your industries with it, I think, again, you would have to transport this energy over large distances, and you would again depend on there being peace. So I would again say the problem of peace is predominant in all these other cases too, and it is not resolved. Finally, certainly the increase of what is called the productivity of the kilowatt hour, of the productivity of energy, can be increased considerably, which other people also call energy saving. This can be increased. This may give a factor of 2 or so, and that's very good. On the other hand, I'm not sure that this is the final solution either, because all the 3 sources which I mentioned are in a way not satisfactory in the present situation of the world. Now, one thing is, I say a world peace is needed, and I hope very much that the things which I'm now saying, and which are well known to the experts, of course, will penetrate public opinion in all parts of the world. On the other hand, I cannot quite avoid thinking that we ought to move toward a more ascetic world culture, world civilization. Thereby I mean a civilization which is able to renounce even such goods which might be had. It is not necessary that we should live in that immense wealth which is at present in the northern part of the world. We could have lived with far less. Just to speak of heating as one thing, I know very well when I was young, in a house in which I lived, there was one room which was heated, and there one lived. And of course the room in which the parents slept or the children slept was never heated. And you needed far less coal or whatever was used for heating under such conditions. We have now come to think that just large expenditure of energy is a good thing, and we should perhaps learn that it is definitely not a good thing, and that we should be more modest in what we want for. This again means a change of heart. And so I come back to my original point. A change of heart, a change of consciousness, and Bewusstseinswandel is a necessary condition for all the things of which I have been speaking. It is not sufficient, and it is necessary to have as far as possible institutional solutions which do not depend on the goodwill of people. But on the other hand, these institutions will never be created unless there is a majority which understands that they are necessary. And therefore, I think what I call change of heart in the majority, not with every single person, but in the common views of the majority, which one doesn't dare to contradict because one feels then people will laugh or they will scold. This is a very important thing. And why do I give this kind of lectures. Well, I hope you all knew it anyway, but still I wanted to communicate with you about this matter too. Thank you.
Well, thank you very, very much. And we have time for some questions, since this has been extremely punctual. Questions or comments, I suppose?
Objections, of course.
Yes, objections.
You spoke very eloquently on a number of topics, which I think things, views that many of us would share, but I don't think one is particular to the scientists in many of these views. The views of intelligent, cultured man, any kind of background, many of them. And you didn't really address the technical issues.
Well, I mean, my answer is perhaps hidden in my first remarks. I said it's a moral obligation of the scientist to be aware of all these things. And therefore, I tried to speak about them. And why just the scientist? Then I would say certainly also the others. But for the scientist, I think there is a little bit more of such an obligation, at least as far as these all these events are somehow produced by science and technology, of course, the two things together. So I would say, when I gave the title, The Moral and Political and Moral Consequences of Science, I wanted to say, and I said it just in one sentence, these are the consequences I hope scientists will draw themselves. That's what I wanted to say.
They realize, or at least the military advisors realize, or think it is possible to have a limited nuclear war. I come from an area which is about 20 kilometers from the East German border, and I know from the maneuvers that are planned there every year that military people plan a limited nuclear war already. For example, in case of a conventional attack from the Russians, I know that my area and my family, for example, would be destroyed from those short-range nuclear defensive missiles from the NATO. So in the light of that, that nuclear war is now seen as a possibility of having a limited nuclear war already, which I think increases by far the danger of having nuclear weapons as such. In the view of that, how do you see the chances of establishing sort of a neutral zone within Europe where all, not only medium, but short range missiles will
Yeah, well, I mean, first I should like to give a little bit of a defense of the views on nuclear deterrence. While I think these views are insufficient and should be replaced by something else. The idea when one says they are preparing a limited nuclear war is, of course, to be prepared for it in order that such an attack will never happen. The intention is not, let's go to nuclear war. The intention is, be strong enough to deter every step which might be taken in an aggressive manner from the other side. So that's the theory. On the other hand, I would say that I would be very much in favor of abolishing especially these very short-range nuclear weapons. I think that we now abolish the medium-range weapons and only retain those weapons which can only reach Germany from Germany. It's certainly not a thing which a German can be very pleased to know. So I fully agree that they ought to be abolished. But then on the other hand, I say, I do not see how we can convince those who are in charge of planning all these things, that they must do that unless we offer an alternative. And an alternative at present, I think, if it is to be a military alternative, would be what I call defensive conventional defense. It is true that this, again, I think, is not the final solution. No technological solution is final. New things are always tried out, and so it may help us for another 10 years, and also it would be expensive. But just to do nothing might be a good thing if the whole nation knew that this might mean to come under political pressure against which no resistance would be possible, and that one would be prepared to accept the consequences of that. As long as a nation is not prepared to accept such consequences, it would feel more secure by having some weapons. And while I have tried for a while to say, well, just try out what would happen if you do not defend yourselves, I found out that this was not at all politically acceptable to the majority, and therefore I ceased proposing such things.
I also wish you had been a little more outspoken on the ethics and responsibility question. I'm a scientist. My own view is that I feel very torn between a position where I feel responsible to look at the consequences of any scientific finding or any new result, mm-hmm. and the feeling that politics is expert business, of which I have no inclination and also no competence really to get involved with. How am I to tell, you know, what's good to do in terms of South African apartheid policy? Is it right to ban import or not? I don't know. So I would wish you could address that a little more explicit. And maybe to give you one example, last year I think at, on the campus here there was an initiative among the natural scientists not to work with Department of Defense money that was somehow associated with the SDI budget, of which I felt very sympathetic, but I don't know if I would have signed it if I had been a natural scientist. What is your feeling about this?
Well, I mean, I wanted to speak about the details about which I have been speaking, and therefore I did not speak very long on moral or ethical problems. Besides also because I feel that just to state a certain ethical rule as absolute is sometimes just a way of evading the real problem. I think, well, take that South African example. If we were not living in a scientific, technological civilization, we would not know about South Africa. It would be very far away. Now we know about it. Now we feel perhaps responsible for what is happening there. Well, if we feel responsible for what is happening there, either we have very strong and direct feelings about it and act accordingly, or we are in doubt, then we can either say, I am not able to be informed about it, I do nothing, or we must inform ourselves more. And my conclusion has been, in those cases for which I felt I couldn't help being responsible, I had to be informed as well as possible. And I think that can be done to a certain extent. So you see, I have a certain reluctance to reduce the difficulty of real responsibility to following moral rules. Certainly moral rules are a very good thing, but no moral rules have a meaning. Sorry?
No categoric imperative for the scientists.
No, exactly the opposite. The categoric imperative says, that's Kant, act in such a manner that the principle of your own action could, under all circumstances, also be applied as a general rule for everybody, as a rule for a general legislation. Now, if you feel sure about such a thing, please act accordingly. Personally, I feel in many cases, I think the general rule would mean, well, make yourself knowledgeable. Understand the matter. And since I am unable to understand everything, I am always a little bit reluctant, just because I feel so very well morally, to take certain steps of which I know that I don't understand what I'm doing there. So in this sense, I'm a bit reluctant against this moralism. On the other hand, certainly without morality, nothing can be achieved. That is quite clear. It's a hard thing. Moral rules in traditional societies are valid without explanation. And as long as you can be sure that this is a good situation, you can act according to them. But in a changing world, I have felt it is important to know the consequences.
Yes, it seems to me that the future of this planet is kind of divided between two superpowers and the countries that they gather around themselves. The Trolling Mall is about 20 countries, but there are many more countries and peoples and scientists around the world. And those countries do not belong to blocs or believe they don't belong to either of the blocs.
Do not belong to what?
Blocks.
I see. Yeah.
To neither.
Yeah, yeah.
And we know that the non-aligned movement tried to do something and it didn't do very much. Is there anything that you can say that the other countries in the world could do to overcome the problems that the two superpowers are having in their power?
Well, I mean,
power?
I mean,
is there anything that scientists and the peoples of the other countries should do or could do to change the complex situation?
Well, certainly something can be done. It now depends on where the other countries are located of which you speak. I mean, I come from a country which is not a superpower and which is in alliance with a superpower. And so this is one situation. If you go to the majority of mankind today, you go to the south, to 600 million Indians or a billion Chinese, or to Latin America or to Africa, and their problems, again, are quite different. So the question is whom you address. As to my own situation, I feel in general that I react the way in which I hope my American friends will react too. I do not see too much of a difference there. But certainly this is always to be found out, whether it can be done or whether it, perhaps we have some special interests. But as to the general peace in the world, there, I would say, the real practical problem of war is in the South. One has counted 130 wars or so. Now, this counting is always a little bit artificial, but the order of magnitude may be right. And quite recently, I was exposed to some studies on these matters in which people, historians, tried to count the number of wars which have happened since 1820. And they found that in our century there were far more wars than in the 19th. But then they also found that the independent sovereign nations, which were considered as being able to wage war, were 23 in 1820 and over 160 now. And if you divide the number of wars by the number of nations, the number of wars per nation is smaller now than earlier. So you see the kind of difficulties in which you run when you try to make a clear quantitative statement about it. But in fact, I feel that the wars in the South, to a large extent, are consequences of local or regional origin. They are not proxy wars of the superpowers. Sometimes such a proxy war may have happened, but in general, I think the superpowers have done more to make such wars impossible or to finish them soon and not to make them, to produce them. And now, since war has been with mankind since at least 6,000 years, and since these wars so far are not destroying the whole civilization, and even not destroying the whole nation in most cases at least, it will be very difficult to do something against them. On the other hand, looking at the feelings which the South has with respect to the North, and I said in the beginning, I take sides with the South in this case. I know from a man who has been working in the United Nations Center in New York in development questions for quite a while in the early 80s, that when he was sitting in some evening with some of his Southern friends, and they had perhaps had a bit of whiskey or so, so their tongue was a little bit easier moved, then one could hear such statements as, why don't these two barbarians of the North not finally wage their war against each other? Then we would be rid of both of them. I think that's a very common feeling. Now, what to do about it is hard to say. Again, if I were to discuss the matter of the war between Iran and Iraq with somebody who is really responsible, I would perhaps try to make some proposals. But then again, it is necessary to know the special situation. In principle, I think it cannot go on the way it does. It cannot indefinitely go on.
Well, what's the last question?
Now in the kindest of ways, entering politics in the political arena, do you find that the political arena is a rational arena? In other words, do the people involved behave in response to rational arguments? If so, why are we still having this problem? And if not, what does this have to say to the way a scientist should behave in the world?
I'm not sure that I acoustically got the main point. The political arena is?
Whether it is rational.
Whether?
The question was, I think,
whether it is rational.
If it is rational, why do we still have the problems we're dealing with? And
well,
if it is not rational, what has
the
scientist got to contribute?
Now I understand. Thank you so much. I have some hearing difficulties, and even modern technology does not fully remove them. Well, I would say, first, you see, I have a tendency first to speak against certain views which are very common, and then to say something which perhaps is not so far from the common view. There is a very common view that politics is a field of special irrationality, and that politicians are those people who don't understand anything and who are not to be trusted. That's a very common feeling, different perhaps in different countries and in different parts of the population. This is a view I do not share. I know quite a number of politicians, and I think as soon as they are not on the television screen, when they are sitting together, they are very rational. Not absolutely. So my impression is the irrationality of the political field is to a large extent just mirroring the irrationality of the majority. And therefore I was speaking about educating the majority. Besides, you can say quite a number of other things, but I think that's the main answer I would like to give.
Well, thank you very, very much.